call House Judiciary together at 11 minutes after the hour of 1. If you would take the roll, please.
Representative Foster?
Here.
Representative Ledoux? Representative Lynn?
Here.
Representative Millett?
Excused.
Representative Pruitt? Representative Grunberg?
Here.
Representative Keller?
Here. And then I just want to say on the record, for the last time, Representative Foster was excused, and I never got that on the record, but it's there now for last week. If anyone, yeah. What we have in front of us today is we're going to start with HB 250, which is the I'm Sorry Bill, is a short title. And we have online the author of the book Sorry Works, Doug Wojcicki. And if Erica, did you want to say something before we start with a bill? I think that we're all up on okay. Doug, are you online?
Yes, this is Doug Wojcicki. How y'all doing today?
Thanks for taking time to come call us, and your testimony will be valuable to us as we are getting ready to act on this bill. So go ahead and identify yourself and who you represent, and give us your testimony.
Chairman Keller?
Sure.
Annie Holt is also online. Is that you, Annie? Hold on just a little bit, Doug.
No, Chairman Keller. This is Representative Millett. I'm just calling in to let you know I'm online.
Okay, thank you. Just stand by. Doug, back to you. If you would, identify yourself for the record, and here's your testimony.
Sure. My name is Doug Wojcicki. Last name is spelled Wojcicki. I am the founder and president of an organization called Sorry Works. I work all around the country with doctors, nurses, healthcare insurance, and legal professionals on I teach them how to disclose and, if necessary, apologize after something goes wrong in a medical setting, be it a hospital or a doctor's office or any other setting where care can be rendered, including a dental office, whatever. And I've been doing this work for seven plus years. Little background myself, I got into it because I lost my oldest brother to medical errors back in May of 1998, and our family didn't get disclosure. We got no communication. We had to file a lawsuit to get any answers. And after a pretty tough process, we got money. But at the time, not even after money exchanged hands and the liability was clear, did the doctors or hospital communicate with us or discuss the mistakes or made that led to his death. So that was a very tough process and something left a mark on me. And I've taken that experience and now I literally go out and talk with doctors and hospitals and say, you know, if you don't want someone like me to sue you, here's what you need to do when things go wrong. I literally take them step by step through the process. I work with defense counsel. I work with plaintiff's counsel on this issue. I work with risk managers, hospital leadership, the whole nine yards. So the piece to the bill that you have before you, I have looked at it. I've reviewed it several times. I've been in communication with Erica, with your staff person, Erica. And this bill is like a lot of bills in many other states. There's, I think, 36, 37 states now that have these. They're called apology laws. And what we've seen, you know, in my work across the country, what I've seen in states that have these bills is that it does, they do help make doctors and nurses more comfortable communicating with patients and families after something goes wrong. And you talk to any plaintiff's lawyer as well as any defense lawyer, they'll tell you the number one reason doctors get sued when something goes wrong is not the possibility of bad care. It's often the total lack of communication, the feelings of abandonment. You know, families feel abandoned. They feel just totally left in the lurch when they want to hear from that doctor. Doctors, from their side, will say they're afraid to talk because it'll be used against them in court, blah, 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 blah. And what these type of bills do is it helps people feel a little more comfortable, and then allows the process by which, you know, people like myself, there's lots of people across the country that do this training, so I'm certainly not here pitching for myself, but there's lots of folks like us that go out there and work with hospitals and doctors, and it makes it a little easier for us to go out and have the conversation with hospitals. It helps defense counsel, get a little more comfortable with allowing docs to talk if something goes wrong. And, you know, I think the big goal, I think what everyone's in this for, doctors, patients, families, lawyers on both sides, is to make medicine safer. If we can make healthcare safer, you know, we should do it. And the fact of the matter is that when doctors talk more after adverse medical events, after things go wrong, be it a known complication or a mistake, when doctors and nurses talk, when they talk more, systems get better, patients and families are safer, and society's better served. So I support this and be happy to take any questions you may have.
Representative Grunberg has a question for you.
Just, if I may, just first put on the record, I will not be offering any of those amendments today, and I will be supporting the bill as is. But I would like to ask, and sir, you pronounce your name how?
Doug. Just call me Doug. It's Doug Wachester.
Doug.
Stick with Doug.
Okay.
It's okay.
Great. Yeah, people call me Max, but we're a little more formal here usually. The question I have, and I'm the co-sponsor on this bill. Are the lawyers or anybody afraid of getting sued for their own malpractice if they advise a doc it's okay to apologize and then things go badly at trial? Will the lawyers themselves be concerned that they may be subjecting themselves to additional exposure for attorney malpractice for giving that advice?
Yeah, that's a good question, Max. I've never heard that question. I've never had that question posed to me. It's a legitimate question. I do know, with or without this type of legislation, you know, however you may be talking about, you know, should a doc disclose or not if something goes wrong, you know, defense counsel have historically been reticent to allow docs to talk, and even now there's a discomfort level, but we're working through those things. And what we are, when I work with defense counsel, and I wrote a book on disclosure with two defense attorneys, sold lots and lots of copies all around the country. What we talk with defense counsel about, what defense counsel talk with me about, and what we all talk collectively with doctors about is, you know, when something goes wrong, just simply saying things in context, which is, you know, gosh, Max, I'm sorry this happened to your mom. We're going to review it to figure out what happened, and we'll get back to you in due process. I could flip your question around on you another way. You know, if I was a doctor and you were my lawyer, Max, you told me to shut up when something goes wrong, and I really wanted to go talk to that family because I really like them and they like me, and you said, Dr. Doug, don't do it. And I followed your advice, and then 6 months later I'm getting sued. You know, who knows? Maybe I have a case for legal malpractice on that. I think there's lots of doctors that if they could probably would, you know, have been given really bad advice through the years of not talking after something goes wrong, and that's what leads to so many lawsuits. So, you know, the general feeling right now, the general movement in medicine and insurance and the risk management world is it's better to talk after something goes wrong as opposed to not talking. If a doc, you know, goes a little too far, if they prematurely admit fault, if they start, you know, jousting or speculating, well, then we'll clean that up with, you know, the documentation with the review, getting the experts in there. You know, I've heard of cases where, you know, docs have, you know, just gone out there and said, you know, Max, sorry, I killed your mom. And the review comes back later, and shows that there was no error. You know, you were, you know, and the way the court would, some courts would look at that as hearsay. So short answer to a long response to you is it's better to talk if something goes wrong, as opposed to not talking. That's where everyone's moving towards. This bill will help that.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
I don't see other questions at this time. Thank you very much for taking time out of your day to call.
You bet. Thanks. Good luck, guys. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Just some housekeeping. Representative Ledoux has joined us, and Representative Millett is online. That's who we heard. It wasn't the other caller, so she's online participating. Annie Holt, are you there from Anchorage, last physicians?
Yes, good afternoon. This is Annie Holt. I'm the Executive Director of Alaska Physicians and Surgeons, and thank you for the opportunity to testify. Our organization, with 150 members, supports House Bill 250, also referred to as the I'm Sorry Law, and we appreciate Representative Kurt Olson for introducing it. Over 30 states have introduced such a law. And the goal of the law is to empower the patient-physician relationship and to encourage dialogue between physicians and patients, especially when there's an unanticipated outcome. Unanticipated outcomes may or may not be directly attributable to the physician's care. As Doug alluded to earlier, oftentimes there are many factors that contribute to that. So a genuine expression of sorrow by the physician, it could be misinterpreted, and physicians are concerned that it increases their liability in the event of a lawsuit. So in the best interest of patients and their physicians, this legislation would support physicians and patients having open conversations and understanding what happened without the specter of liability.
Thank you, Annie. I don't see any questions at this time. Is there anybody else online that I have missed that wants to talk to this bill? Anybody in the room that wants to testify? Erica, do you want to do any wrap-up, or are we okay? Okay, so we're going to close public testimony at this point, and it's in front of the committee for discussion, debate, all movement. I want to say, by the way, just before we talk, thank you for joining Representative Olson. She thanked Representative Olson, but I'm glad to see you on this co-sponsor. It's a good bill.
If I may say something, we had an amendment that would have put language about the civil rules. You raised a point in a conversation with Kurt and me on the floor. Your point was very well taken, and had I offered it, I would have offered it in a little different form as a result of your conversation, and we could have done it, and I'll talk to you privately, and Erica, if she's interested. Do you want a motion?
Yes, please.
Yes, I would move that we pass CS House for House Bill 250 HESS, that's Work Order 28 LS0967 /P as in Papa, from the House Judiciary Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Okay. I don't see any objections, and we'll take a little at ease. On the record, to give you a little bit of perspective of where we're going here, HB 362 is next. That's on restricting illicit synthetic drugs, specifically advertising. And then we have HB 315, which is jury nullification. And then last half of the committee meeting will be SB 64, and we'll do the same pattern on Friday, and we'll stop the other bills no matter where we're at. We don't have any intention today of moving either one of these bills. We want to get them on the record, give them a little time to think it through, and we'll go from there. So, Representative Grunberg, did you have a question before?
Just a request, if we could take a couple minutes to look at the at least one of the other bills, get permission to put the bill in.
Representative Grunberg, that's a little out of order from what we're doing right now. But
no, I know.
I will go in front of you. You've got the possibility of two. This is just for the committee housekeeping. You got two bills that we're considering for judiciary bills. But anyway, we're on to CS. We have a blank CS in front of us, number 362. And we're going to start with version uniform unless there's any objection, and it's just for the purposes of presentation, so I won't ask for a motion, but I want to just clarify for the record that uniform is in front of us, and we have the sponsor's staff here. Representative Grunberg?
Do you wish a motion so we have it officially in front of us?
Go for it.
Okay. With your permission, Mr. Chair, I move for discussion only that the House Judiciary Committee consider the uniform version of House Bill 362. It's currently currently blank, and it's the label of the work order is 28LS1538/U as in uniform, Strasbourg 318, 2018.
And I'll object for purposes of the discussion. And go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Judiciary Committee, for the record, Ike Galopsis, staff to Representative Millett. With the committee's indulgence, Mr. Chairman, I would like to turn the table over to Ms. Edra Morledge from Senator Meyer's staff to explain the provisions of the bill, the changes, and answer any questions.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Edra Morledge, staff to Senator Meyer. We have the Senate version SB 173 that we have been carrying through the Senate side this session. So, just to give you a little background on this bill, as you know, Senator Meyer has sponsored legislation in the past, and the legislature has passed legislation previously to outlaw synthetic cannabinoids, otherwise known as bath salts, and various other names. And these are commonly drugs that are used as alternatives to cocaine or marijuana. They're sold by the gram in small packets in convenience stores and smoke shops and are easily accessible. Unfortunately, many people think that these drugs are safe to use, including parents, because it is so readily available. They're actually not safe. They cause many psychotropic effects on users of the synthetic drugs. These two bills, Representative Millett's and Senator Meyer's, are an attempt to stop the sale of these illicit synthetic drugs by targeting the way that they're packaged rather than the chemical compounds in the synthetic cannabinoids. What happens is the manufacturers of these drugs, who are often overseas, simply change the compounds that we've previously outlawed by a molecule or two, and all of a sudden they're not illegal any longer. In Anchorage, the Assembly recently passed an ordinance to ban the packaging of synthetic cannabinoids, which is the approach that we're taking. We've modeled this legislation on that ordinance, and it's been very successful in Anchorage. They virtually wiped it out of all of the smoke shops and convenience stores in Anchorage. And I believe that we're the only state at this point that's taking this approach to target the packaging rather than the compounds. So we don't really have any research about, What I'm trying to say is that it hasn't really been challenged as far as a state law, and I know that on the East Coast in Maine, they've passed an ordinance, which the Anchorage ordinance was modeled on, and they have not been challenged either, to my knowledge. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I know that we have folks from departments here that can answer questions. I believe our drafter is online also, who can speak to the way that the legislation was drafted to try to make the ordinance language work within our state statutes. And that concludes my presentation.
Okay, before we open it up to questions, in just a minute, I want to tell you who's online. We have Quinlan Steiner from the Public Defender Agency, and we also have Kathleen, the drafter, like you just said. And also there's one testifier in from Kenai. So anyway, Representative Ledoux has a question.
So I'm trying to figure out, okay, so does it have to be both false and misleading, or does not specify the name of the synthetic drug, or does not specify the name and place of the manufacturer, packer, or distributor, and then one or the other of those and all of the rest of two? Is that the way it's supposed to be?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I will let Kathleen Strasbaugh, the drafter, speak to that, but my understanding is that it would have to meet one from Section 1 and one from Section 2. Not all, but I would defer to the drafter.
Kathleen, did you hear the question?
Yes, this is Kathleen Strasbaugh, Legislative Legal Services, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, the answer is yes, one from B and one from B1 and one from B2.
So can I follow up here?
Representative Ledoux.
So why wouldn't they just put the identity of the substances contained in the synthetic drug? If it's legal that way, why wouldn't the manufacturer just put it on the label, if all you have to do to not fall within this is stick the substances on the label?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I don't have all of the facts associated with this bill, but it's my understanding that the trade in these products does not like the scrutiny and does not want to provide that information. But as I said, there are people that can better answer that than I.
Is there anybody on?
Representative Ledoux, let's let the sponsor respond.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux.
Identify yourself again for the record.
Edra Moorledge again. Cindy Franklin, the municipal city prosecutor in Anchorage, should be online, and she can answer those questions. The short answer is that they're being marketed as things that they're not, which is they're being marketed as incense, or it will say not for human consumption, when the reality is that's exactly what it's intended to be for. So that is one reason why they would put a misleading label on there, not put exactly what's in the packaging. But I'd rather have the city prosecutor speak to that.
I would assume that it would be Gus Sundahl.
Should be Cindy Franklin.
Okay, I don't see a prosecuting attorney on here. We have Quinlan from the public defenders, and we have the drafter. So. If he comes on shortly, we can ask him. we're not moving the bill today, so it's okay to get questions like that on the record, and we can proceed to work on them. Kathleen, I have another question for you. Am I reading this right? Then you answered Representative Ledoux, but I just wanted to make sure I understood it. It looked to me like if the synthetic drug label is misleading, you pick that out of B1, and mm-hmm. then you go to B2 and pick one out. And it seems like a criteria would be that it suggests that it's a stimulating item. It occurred to me that that could be instant coffee. And so I'm a little bit nervous about, the potential scope of the bill. Yeah, I was wondering if you had any comments on that.
Kathleen Strasbaugh, Legislative Legal Services. Mr. Chairman, this bill depends on mislabeling, and if someone is purveying something that's made of coffee, it strikes me that they would not be wanting to disguise it. There's another law, imitation controlled substances, where that something like that might occur, but the element of falsity is necessary for a violation to be committed under this statute, and so I don't see that the harmless substances or the substances that are not the substances that like coffee are going to end up being there's going to end up being a disproportionate punishment.
Well, questions on the record, and I'll consider that. As I go through it and look at different combinations from B1 and B2, it just seems like there's room there. But Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I totally agree with you, by the way. Now, I agree with Representative Ledoux also. And the first thing is a drafting thing. If the members would look at line 13 on page 1, I'm sorry, line 11 on page 1, the intent there is correctly drafted because it must have A, B, or C as one prong, and that's disjunctive. The word or is key. So you don't have to have A, B, and C. And then to make certain that you have to have one prong from number one and one prong from number two, the word and appears on page 1, line 13. However, you only have to have A through G, one of those, under prong 2. And the word or does not appear at the end of line 18, like it does appear at the end of line 11. And I think that to be clear on this, I'll offer an amendment at the appropriate time to ensure that it's only one from sub 2 to insert the word or. My first question is to Ms. Strausbaugh with the chair's permission.
Representative Grunberg.
May I ask her a question?
You may ask her a question,
but
don't answer one again. I mean, over and over again, but ask. Go ahead.
I just want to make sure that what I'm saying would make sure that A through G are disjunctive if we put the word or at the end of line 18 on page 2. Is that not correct, Ms. Strausbaugh?
Kathleen and Representative Grunberg, with all due respect, let's work that out with the sponsor and with the let's just get the questions online so we have those, and that way.
If I may just.
And that was clear. Yeah, sure.
It's not clear to me, I would think, that whether each sale would be a separate offense and a separate violation. Is that the intent of the bill? So if you sold 10 of these packages to one person and 3 to another, you would have committed 13 separate offenses. Is that what your intent is, through the chair?
Through the chair, Edra Moreledge, Representative Grunberg, that is correct. That is the intent, that it would be a $500 violation per package.
Mr. Chair, then I will ask you to consider another amendment that specifies that each sale is a separate offense, so there is no question. And my third thing, if I may, Mr. Chair.
President Grunberg?
I am somewhat concerned, quite concerned about the question you asked, Mr. Chair. We have things that are depending upon, quote, street names in page 2, line 20. And who knows what somebody might call it on the street if you're in the south side of Anchorage as opposed to the east side or the west side, wherever. How is that going to be survive a test for vagueness? And same, we have to look at each one of these things. And I would just ask the sponsor, are they aware that we, at least I will ask some of those questions, because I see this thing not being challenged as a whole bill, but in an individual case where they pick something from Category A and something from Category B, and I see one thing as legal, and somebody will say, well, I bought a legal drug. I mean, that's kind of ridiculous, but you see what I'm saying, and I'd ask the sponsor any comment on that.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, Edra Moreledge, we'd be happy to work with you on language that you feel would be tighten that up.
Representative Lynn?
Yes, and on that point, Representative Grunberg, on page 2, beginning with line 19 as G, all these interesting esoteric names, what happens if somebody comes up with a new name that's not included in this list? So, it could be anything. So how does that work out if somebody comes up with a new name tomorrow and But this is an amazing list of names.
We'd have to amend the law.
Yeah. Okay. So, did you have a response?
I do. Edra Morledge again. Representative Lynn, the reason why all of these names are included in here now is because these are ones that we know of right now. So immediately, these meet the threshold for Section 2, one from this list here. We understand that those will change over time and they'll morph, and maybe at some point we just take them out and all together. But right now we know that these are existing synthetic drugs that we would like off the street immediately.
Representative Lynn?
Is there any way to put something in here that would include future such names, future such street names?
Through the chair, we would be happy to work on that. Language that was
That's great questions, I think, on the record. I think the committee's doing a good job. The Representative Millett, you're listening. Do you have anything you want to add at this point?
No, I think those were good questions, Chair Keller. And, like I said, we'll be willing to work with both Representative Groenberg and Representative Lynn on coming up with some good definitions on that. I mean, it's an ever-changing group of names, and that's what we struggle with, and it's an ever-changing group of drugs that are mixed in with these spice pills. So it's really hard to capture everything. I mean, what we're trying to do is just make sure that, you know, kids don't have access to these drugs and people aren't selling these drugs. So that's the intent, and we'll work with whoever to make the bill better.
Thank you, Rep. Millett. Representative Ledoux, did you have a question?
A couple of them. Any definition of false and misleading?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I would defer to our drafter for that.
Kathleen, did you hear the question? And speak into the mic, please.
Any definition for false or misleading?
Maybe Kathleen is. Are you still there? Kathleen?
I'm sorry, I was muted. Kathleen Strauss, Legislative Legal Services. Through the chair, Representative Ledoux. Those terms are in frequent use in the statutes. I'm sure that a definition could be put together if someone wanted one.
Okay. Well, so, follow up, Representative Ledoux.
Is it often when it's drafted, it might say false and misleading, as that term is defined in AS, whatever it's defined in, or is it just generally that you just use the term false and misleading?
It's been my impression, although I haven't researched it and I'm clicking away right now, that we use the term without definition, at least in some areas of the statute. I see.
That's all right. We don't want to fix it right now. But it's a good question to have on record. Thank you. Is there another one, Representative?
Well, I just want to make it clear that I'm really looking forward to somebody answering at some future committee meeting why somebody simply couldn't get around this by not making something that was false or misleading, specifying the substances contained in it, and specifying the name and the place of the manufacturer, packer, or distributor. I mean, if it's not illegal, other than because of this law, which says that it can't be misleading, et cetera, why wouldn't somebody simply jump through the hoops and do it in order to comply with this aspect of the law?
Mr. Chairman, very briefly.
Yeah, Ike, if you would identify yourself for the record and make a stab at responding, but we'll take that as a record on the record, and we can pick up on that too. But go ahead.
You got it, Mr. Chairman. For the record, again, Ike Galopso, staff to Representative Millett. Mr. Chairman, Representative Ledoux, the overwhelming majority, if not the totality, of this particular synthetic substance comes from China, and so in order for it to actually enter the country under those pretenses, it would have to comply with the FDA, and it wouldn't be able to do so in order to meet those requirements.
So we got some work to do.
What? Follow up?
Representative Ledoux?
Why not? Why wouldn't it be able to meet the FDA? And if it can't meet the FDA, then why isn't it illegal without this law?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ledoux, that is an excellent question that I will not be answering at this point because I can get that for you later.
Okay, what we're going to do is go to public testimony now. We have one person, I think, that's... Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't see it. Representative Grunberg has a question.
Thank you. And this is a question primarily for Ms. Strasbow, although Edna may want to say something on it. Looking at the language on page 3, line 17, that the Commissioner of Public Safety may delegate the authority under this chapter, quote, as appropriate, unquote. Is that phrase the phrase that's normally used? Because it doesn't specify any, first of all, any outer limits of what may be delegated as authority and whether there that could be unconstitutional. For example, an unconstitutional delegation of legislative authority. And it doesn't specify or limit to whom that may be delegated. It could be to a non-governmental agency or anything, and I guess at some point I'd like to know if that's the usual language, and if it is, how it's well-defined, because otherwise I see potentially a problem with the scope of the authority and to whom it may be given.
Case point, question well made, and it's on the record, and I see the sponsor's representative nodding. So, Gus Sandahl. Are you online? If you are, identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony. And I assume you've been listening. And go ahead.
Yeah, yes, I have, Mr. Chair, and thank you for this opportunity. My name is Gus Sandahl. I'm a resident of Kenai. I also work in law enforcement, and I just wanted you all to hear from someone out there that at least have one person who's very supportive of our state lawmakers taking steps to prohibit the sale and possession of these substances across all of Alaska. And I've listened to everything you said so far, and I can tell you're all thinking like many of us are probably out there and trying to eliminate as many loopholes as you can think of within reason. So I appreciate you taking the time to work on this and for considering it. That's all I had.
Thank you very much, Gus, for your testimony. And, yes, I agree with you. Compliments to the sponsor of the bill. We need to see if we can make this one work. So with that, we're going to put Representative Grunberg.
I do apologize. As I'm looking at this, and I must confess I haven't studied it as much as I should, I have two more questions I'll just put out there into the ether.
Okay.
Number one, on the section with the penalties, which is page 3, lines 21 and 22. A person who violates this is guilty of a violation. Now, are you intending to punish the person who makes the drugs, who wholesales them, who retails it, or all three? Because I could see somebody selling somebody a pack, making it, wholesaling it, selling it, and you could have a total of three people punished for this one package, or who's intended to be the intended defense. And secondly, the word on page 3, line 30, a chemical or chemical compound intended to do certain things. The question is, who would have to have the intent, and how are you going to prove it? Is it going to be the person who made it, person who wholesaled it, the person who retailed it, or what? And I'm not trying to be difficult. I support the concept, but I'm trying to save it from what I see is potential serious challenges to it the way it is.
Thank you, Representative Grunberg, and I want to point out that I did not mean to imply that we needed a comprehensive list. We may have others, you know, but I appreciate it, and if you see any between now and then, bring it up to the sponsor and Representative.
You know, I'm wondering, and I'm not sure who I should be directing this question to, exactly why the person is guilty of a violation as opposed to a misdemeanor. I mean, a violation, I think, is a civil thing rather than a criminal thing. So is the intent of that, because if it's civil, you're not entitled to a public defender, you're not entitled to trial by jury, is that the reason for making it a violation as opposed to a misdemeanor?
You don't have to respond to that now, but that's a question that will be open-ended for the record when we come back. So thank you, and I'm sure my excellent staff got that written, but you can make sure of it. And I know the sponsors are listening, too. So with that, we're going to press on. It's an interesting situation here where we have a bill coming up here now, HB 315. We've got 10 minutes. And it's not a 10-minute bill, I assure you. So what we're going to do is just get the presentation. I'm going to ask for no questions at this point. This is just to get it in our mind. We're not going to rush this bill through at some future point. That's not the intent. The intent is to get it in front of the committee so we can bring it up at a future date and continue our discussion. So if you would, make your presentation, and if you would, keep your eye on the clock because I've made promises for 2 o'clock.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Representative Tammy Wilson. I represent District 2 North Pole. First of all, I'd like to apologize for my misunderstandings to anybody who may be on the line to testify, but we will be getting back to those on the list and letting them know when the intent of the committee is to hear public testimony. HB 315 is an act relating to juries in criminal cases, basically jury nullification. Before one is able to understand why jury nullification is a good idea, one must understand the importance of a trial by jury. Our founding fathers considered them to be a weapon, powerful weapon in the war against tyranny. Thomas Jefferson wrote, "I consider trial by jury as the only anchor yet imagined by man by which a government can be held to the principles of its Constitution." In the Federalist Papers, Alexander Hamilton wrote that trial by jury was a very palladium of free government and a valuable check upon corruption. As for the concept that juries have not only the power but the obligation to nullify unjust rulings of a judge, John Adams wrote, "It is not only the juror's right but his duty to find the verdict according to his own best understanding, judgment, and conscience, though in direct opposition to the direction of the court." Our founding fathers zealously defended this right and recognized that only an informed and empowered jury could effectively protect a defendant from the potentially harmful effects of judges. Jury nullification allows citizens to have the final say on what is fair in a court of law. Therefore, jury nullification is a good idea and one supported by constitutional principles and freedoms. And I know you have a big bill in front of you, but as we've been talking about this, I want to make sure that in your packet that you'll see that there's a total of 27 states that have some form of jury nullification. And interestingly enough, most of them are within their own state constitution, not ours. So, I mean, so this is something new. And New Hampshire just finished passing a jury nullification. And just to have you ponder on a little thing, and we'll end with this, is that as we've talked about that in our office, if one were to truly believe that when a person goes in, before they get on a jury, that once they go into that jury box, that they will leave all of their past experiences, all their biases, everything outside that jury box and literally base their decision upon the testimony, upon the instructions of the judges, then you would have to ask yourself, why don't we just go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 and take that number? The point is that people do take what they believe the law says by their experiences, by their biases or whatever there is. So, in my opinion, a lot of this is already going on. What this bill basically says is we want the judge to give us permission to do it. So I will leave you with that thought and look forward to the debate that we will have on this important bill.
Right. And, I join you in apologizing if there's people online that called in, but that is the plan, to just take these and stop at 2 o'clock. But we do have a few minutes, so what I would like to do is ask Annie if she'll come up from the Department of Law and give us a perspective, because she signed up, to speak on it, and that will give us a chance to, give us a context for understanding.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Annie Carpinetti, and I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. And I have 2 very short comments to make today because I know you're in a hurry. But we have a couple of serious concerns with this bill. The first is the fact that it allows the defendant to have the jury instructed that they may disregard the law as given to the judge and to all of us by the people who make the law. That is you. you're the people that make the law that we try and enforce to the best of our ability when we charge people with crimes. And a second concern that we have is the fact that it basically allows a defendant in a criminal case to ask the judge to disregard our rules of evidence, which have been written with a view of making a trial as fair as possible. And so, for one thing, it requires the evidence to be relevant. Well, evidence has to be relevant now under the law, but there are various rules that try and dictate evidence that's just maybe too prejudicial to be fair, or is hearsay and not reliable enough to be introduced for consideration by the jury. But this allows it to come in if it's relevant in any way, even though it might be specifically disallowed in statute, because there are some statutes dealing with evidence, or in our evidence code. And then it allows the state to come back and rebut that. And I think that what we would find is that allowing the jury to disregard, the court to disregard our rules of evidence, would result in trials that are not very orderly or not very fair to either side. Thank you.
Thank you very much for putting that on the record. You can tell we've got some fun discussions ahead, I hope. It's a good, and thank you so much, and thank you to the sponsor. What we're going to do now is go right into SB 64. And what I want to ask is that Jordan comes up and gives us, there's a couple questions on the table that were left on the table last time on SB 64, and his response to those will kind of put us on track, and then we'll go right into public testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. Just wanted to briefly talk about the questions that the committee had on the first three sections of the bill. Those were the custodial interference sections. And there was some debate last meeting about whether those sections would be more appropriate in perhaps attempted kidnapping statutes or the kidnapping statutes themselves. And so I did a little bit of research. I prepared a memo that the committee members should have. And so just to rehash, these sections were added through an amendment in the Senate Judiciary Committee. And the issue was brought to the committee's attention after hearing some testimony from a constituent in Anchorage. And so the scenario that this constituent relayed to us was that a man walked into a school. He represented himself as the lawful parent of a child, probably with the intent of kidnapping the child. And the employees of the school knew that he wasn't the lawful custodian. They sent him away. The man actually returned that very same day and tried to do the exact same thing with another child. And that gentleman was charged with criminal mischief in the fourth degree. Now, to the discussion about the attempted kidnapping statutes, there are no attempted kidnapping statutes, but you can prosecute an attempted kidnapping under the general attempt statutes, as Representative Gruenberg mentioned last meeting. That's AS 1131-100. And the reason that the Department of Law could not charge that individual with the attempted kidnapping, they didn't feel that they could successfully prove the attempt. The individual was simply representing himself as a parent. He was just simply saying, I am the father of this child, but that doesn't quite reach the level required to prove attempt. Attempt would require a substantial step towards restraining another person with the intent to hold that person. So why is it in the custodial interference statute? That's because although the crime is committed by a non-relative, the offender is attempting to portray themselves as a relative. They're trying to portray themselves as a lawful custodian. And they're saying that they have a right to custody, so that's why the decision was made to put it into the custodial interference statutes.
Okay, thank you. And that kind of brings us up to date. Is there any questions for Jordan before Representative Gruenberg?
First of all, I hope that Jordan will convey to the sponsor and any other interested parties my comments were made in an attempt to assist the legislation, not to torpedo it. That's number one. I just want that on the record. Number two, I've talked to Senator Wilikowski, who's the author of this, and I want to review this. This is a big bill, and warrants some careful consideration. And as you know, that's what I do.
Right. And what we'll do, that brings to mind, what we'll do is, just so we can all have a target, sometime next week, and I'll announce it at least one meeting before, that we'll have all in and all done. Of course, that never works, but as best we can on the potential amendments, you know, to the bill. And absolutely, yeah, thanks. So thank you, Jordan. What we're going to do is we'll go right to the room here and take the testimony of the folks that here that want to testify. And the first one I have listed is Chris Gifford from Public Safety. Identify yourself and give us your testimony, Chris.
And thank you, members of the House Judiciary Committee. My name is Sergeant Chris Gifford. I'm the president of the Juneau Police Department Employees Association, and I'm testifying today on behalf of PSEA. I've been a police officer for 15 years and have certainly handled a lot of theft cases. And today I'd like to talk about the felony threshold portion of this bill. The cases that I've handled have ranged from very minor in nature all the way to very serious, and those are property crimes. Police officers and state troopers who investigate property crimes in Alaska take all of their cases seriously. For instance, and one of the things I am here to do today is speak from my experience as a police officer in Juneau, so I can't necessarily always speak towards maybe someone who's an officer in Anchorage. I don't work for Anchorage Police. But for instance, in Juneau, if there's a person that were to steal something as minor as a corn dog, and another person that was stealing a DVD player, in both of those instances, one being very minor, one a little more serious, the officer's going to, or the complainant or the business owner in that event is going to get a uniformed law enforcement to respond to their business. The police are accountable to their citizens, and business owners are no exception. As it is currently, there is seldom a situation, at least in my experience, that is called in that receives no personal attention or action by a law enforcement officer. What does happen, however, is that police prioritize their level of calls for service. Crimes against persons generally, as they should, receive a response at a greater priority level than property crimes. What this means in realistic terms is, using my early example, if one officer is working in a beat within that area and there is a theft of a DVD player that comes in, and at the same time in the same area a domestic violence report comes in, that officer is going to go to the domestic violence incident first. And depending on the findings of that officer when he or she arrives, it could take an hour or more, particularly if there's an arrest made or a person needs to be relocated to a safe house. But that DVD theft is still there pending, and they're still going to get to that. What it can feel like to the person reporting that DVD theft is that they're being ignored. But this is not the case. The officer involved is appropriately dividing their time and prioritizing their time. In Juneau, an officer will respond to a theft regardless of the monetary amount. Even if it's a very minor theft we've had them from months before and we've still investigated the cases. Raising the threshold for property crimes will not change the police response to them. We respond to all crimes as we can when we are able in relation to other pending calls. Police always place crimes against person at a higher priority. Delays in the response and the response time to property crimes, if that is an issue, can be alleviated. That's usually more of a staffing issue, and it can be alleviated by, you know, adding officers to departments or increasing staff. But unless a certain department's policy restricts their response, we're going to go, and we're going to investigate it. Raising the felony threshold from 500 to 1,200 is reflective of inflation over the years. I think it's fair. Further, many times a person accused of a theft of 500 is convicted of a misdemeanor crime anyway. They may have been charged with a felony, but what they're really ending up with is a misdemeanor conviction. I think that raising that level, you know, over twice what it is now, puts some serious pressure on prosecutors to keep those felony cases as felony cases. Someone that makes a $2,000 theft, I think, deserves a felony conviction. They deserve some incarceration, and they deserve some supervised probation and or parole over a period of time. And I think all property crimes should be prosecuted vigorously, but the statute should be fair and reflective of current monetary values in time for charging purposes. Thank you very much, and I'm available for any questions if needed.
Thank you, Chris. First question is, so you're saying that the property threshold really makes no difference as far as the Anchorage?
We investigate violations, which aren't even crimes. If we're dispatched to a traffic violation, that's we go. If we can, we go. When I say if we can, that means if there's something more serious pending, we're taking that first.
Representative Ledoux.
But when you say more serious pending, I understand, obviously, you would respond to a personal danger more than a property crime. But what many merchants seem to be concerned about is that if you raise the property crime to 1,200, that something that is, let's say, 1,000 or 750, that's now a misdemeanor. Is that going to be taken as seriously as the $1,200 or more?
It will prejudice them to where they couldn't make a rational decision in the case. Now that
I don't know who is online talking, but
defies logic.
It's not your mic. You might need to be. Did you want to respond, Chris?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair.
Oh, we want to call NetEase. I guess we got a problem. Back on the record, if you are online, don't speak unless we ask you to, because it really confuses, as you can see, it really confuses us. So, Chris, did you want to respond or read
that? Thank you, Representative Ledoux, through the chair. I believe, if I remember correctly, your question was, if the felony threshold is raised, would we take those crimes more seriously than others? Police are fact finders. We gather the facts of the case, and once we have develop sufficient probable cause, if there is probable cause, and if there isn't, we don't have it. But we don't base our fact-finding on the level of a monetary amount. Certainly a felony-level case over the course of a whole criminal process will involve more legal aspects, but I'm not a lawyer, and I can't speak to that. That would be more of a question to the Department of Law or to an attorney. I can only speak from my experience as a patrol officer and a patrol supervisor.
Thanks for coming in.
Can I just follow up on that?
But we have quite a list, so let's not take...
So in other words, if you got called out and there was something which was obviously not more than, let's say, $750, and there was another thing which was obviously more than $1,200, that the incident that was more than $1,200 would not be investigated any more seriously than the incident which was clearly less than $750.
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, a very typical case for us here in Juneau is the theft of a bottle of liquor from a liquor store and accompanying surveillance footage that is often turned into us weeks or even months after the fact, when someone goes through and reviews the footage and sees, there's a man stealing a bottle. In those cases, we, through the surveillance, will try to identify the person, find the person. The bottle of liquor, any evidence to be gathered in that regard, is usually gone by that time. However, we can still conduct our interviews. And the evidence we have in this case would be the video surveillance itself, and perhaps even a photo lineup to the clerk. And beyond that, unless there are witnesses to be identified, and there's not much in a shoplifting theft like that, there's really not that much more. Whether it's a $500 case or a $22 case, not that much more to get. And we do the best we can and what we have, and if we have the probable cause, that case is prosecuted, or at least from our office, it's prosecuted. Whether or not the prosecutors accept that, I can't speak on behalf of them.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for taking time to come in. Jeff Jesse?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
Just a follow-up, if I could.
A follow-up question for Chris?
To the gentleman who was just here.
if I may, Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenberg.
The effect of this bill, and I'm looking at Section 7 as an example, currently, if the value of the merchandise is $500 or more, it's a Class C felony. Under the bill, if the value was $1,200 or more, it would be a felony. Between $500 and $1,200, there's a difference. Currently, it's prosecuted as a felony. Under the bill, it will only be prosecuted as a Class A misdemeanor. Is there a difference in level of attention that's spent in potentially prosecuting a felony as opposed to a misdemeanor?
You're asking me about prosecution, and I'm not a prosecutor.
Change it to you. Investigation, your job, not the prosecutor's. Is there a difference?
Representative Greenberg, through the chair. I think in my previous example, we get all the facts that we can in a theft case. And if we still have leads that are uncovered, we try to close up those leads. That means when I speak of leads, that would mean a witness that needs to be interviewed, that maybe isn't there that we have to track down. But any physical evidence, we are not doing our job 100% if we're not trying to get all the evidence that we possibly can. And so in the cases of a felony theft, from a business, there's usually not a whole lot of difference. The monetary amount only talks about the charging, but we do the same fact finding whether it's a misdemeanor or a felony. And then from the prosecution level, what happens from that point on? A lot of times, I can tell you that a lot of times an arrest is not made in a felony, just because of from the prosecutor's standpoint. They need to schedule a grand jury and things like that, and so a lot of times we'll gather the information and file the charges with the prosecutor's office, and the person may walk away at that point, but later go in front of a grand jury, be indicted and arrested on an arrest warrant.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
That question's been answered several times, and we appreciate it. So, Jeff, thank you very much. If you come up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Jesse. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, and it's my pleasure to testify in favor of Senate Bill 64. It's actually somewhat rare in my experience to find a bill that is both so timely and strategic as this bill is. And let me give you a little bit of context. As some of you may know, the House Finance Committee has recently attached intent language to the budget. And what that intent language says is that the court system, the Department of Corrections, the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, the Department of Health and Social Services, the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, and the Mental Health Trust need to continue to work together and come up with a plan to reduce recidivism and avoid building another prison in 2016, which is the path that we're currently on if we keep doing what we're doing and don't do something different. And it isn't like these agencies haven't already been working on these issues. The Criminal Justice Working Group has a reentry task force. They have been working on how to enhance the process of reentry so that people don't recidivate. But it's going to require a much broader scaled set of actions in order to avoid building what will probably be a $300 million prison with about a $50 million operating budget, probably within the next 4 or 5 years. And I think what the Finance Committee was responding to is the fact that we need a sustainable budget going forward. And building new prisons every 4 to 6, 8 years is unlikely to support that type of a sustainable budget. Now, why is this bill such an important first step? Well, it contains a number of important components that certainly would be keystones to that type of an effort to reduce recidivism. For example, raising the property crime threshold for a felony, it's time. It hasn't been changed in quite some time. Recently, I had a conversation with my representative, Craig Johnson, and he reminded me that we incarcerate people for really two reasons. We're either mad at them or we're afraid of them. And when you get into theft crimes, although sometimes we're afraid of them, mostly we're mad at them because they stole our stuff. Well, the fact that over time inflation has made stuff more expensive in dollar value doesn't necessarily mean we're madder at them for the same behavior that we were mad at them for when we set these thresholds originally. So clearly the threshold needs to be increased. Now, whether you look at this as a economics equation and you look at inflation, or if you look at it politically to take concerns of the merchant industry into account, that's your job. But clearly there needs to be a change in the threshold. The commission, the Criminal Justice Commission that's created under this bill, is also very important. If you want to control the prison population, you need to start reviewing the sentencing guidelines that we have in state law and make sure that those sentencing guidelines and requirements are where you want them to be, so that we're only incarcerating people for the particular circumstances that we want them incarcerated for, and that we're incarcerating them for the period of time that is most appropriate to achieve the goals not only of setting public standards of behavior, but also those sentences that would be most beneficial in terms of rehabilitation and preventing recidivism. The recidivism fund is also a key element. You know, again, another prison, $300 million in capital costs, $50 million in operating costs. Obviously, you can't reduce recidivism for nothing. Now, we're getting smarter in using the resources that we already have, but clearly there's going to be a need for some additional resources. This is no different than the Bring the Kids Home initiative, where we knew that we needed to reinvest dollars that the state was spending out of state in in-state services to serve those children. In this case, we're looking at the long-term budgetary sustainability of our budgets and looking at what strategic investments need to be made in order to reduce recidivism, reduce the population of people in prison, and avoid building another prison. The 24/7 sobriety program is an evidence-based practice that has proven very effective across many jurisdictions in keeping people sober and keeping them from recidivating. As we know, virtually a vast majority of people in corrections had substance abuse, particularly alcohol, connected with their criminal behavior. We're not saying it necessarily caused the criminal behavior, but that association and the reduction in judgment that comes from being intoxicated is very important. So this is an evidence-based practice as well. So also the good time for participating in treatment. Again, the basic things you need to keep people from recidivizing are they need housing, they need a job, and they need support for their continued sobriety and recovery. This bill, I think, is a huge first step to getting us started on a plan that will not only reduce recidivism, but we believe it will be in your long-term budgetary best interests as well.
Thank you for your testimony. Just from the broad picture, from your testimony, I'm presuming you don't see any big areas that have been missed, and not without getting into the weeds, I mean, it's pretty comprehensive from your perspective.
Representative Keller, I think this is a great start. It hits some of the main areas that you would want to start advancing your thinking in.
Right.
Does it have every idea that we're probably going to end up bringing forward? No. But absolutely it covers I think a pretty broad cross-section of the things you'd want to start working on right now.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to ask this to the other lawyers who testify. Very recently, a district court judge in Montana, equivalent to the Superior Court, declared that their 24/7 statute was unconstitutional. And that ruling, which I have a copy of, I haven't really read it, I've started it, is on appeal to the Montana Supreme Court. And I don't want to put anybody on the spot, at least today. I'll try to get copies of the stuff I have to anybody who's interested. Like people's views on that, are we potentially running into constitutional problems here? I don't necessarily
think it's a real strong opinion, but I think we ought to have it out there.
I saw the sponsor's representative making notes and nodding, so we'll get that one addressed.
Well, and Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, is a recovering attorney. I haven't seen that particular decision. But we place lots of conditions on release for folks, and I would be surprised if there was a compelling constitutional argument against requiring sobriety as one of the major conditions for release.
I got to say one thing, Wes. I once took a trial course, and the question to the witness was, would you be surprised to know that? Boy, that got left over, so don't put yourself there.
Diane Costo. I didn't look far enough on the list. I'm sorry. Peggy Brown, did you want to testify? Identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Peggy Brown. I am the executive director for the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. And there were two items I really wanted to mention here today. And I think some of them might get unpacked, as you have mentioned, Mr. Chairman, as the bill moves along. One of our concerns... when we first saw the bill, we were okay with it being in the Department of Corrections. And as the bill changed and it became a part of Health and Human Services, we have some concerns about victim safety. And some of those concerns may not be real as we get down into the weeds of this program. We fully understand the need to do something about our prison population. I understand $138 a day for jail and $2 a day for a sobriety program make a big fiscal impact. One of the things that we're concerned about is whether or not Health and Social Services, actually the ASAP program, can deal with offenders who have been drinking, who are have been violent offenders, either sexual predators, domestic violence, and that remains a question of ours. So I'm just bringing that to the committee's attention. I understand that DOC is a consultant, and to our point of view, there may be quite a bit of consulting and contracting. So those states that we have looked at, particularly Montana and South Dakota, in which they have done 24/7 programs, have had a very strong, swift, immediate law enforcement response. So in some ways, this is a program that, while might be evidence-based in its practice, in its structure may not be. However, we are definitely supportive of some kind of program that works on sobriety. As some of my previous colleagues have mentioned, you know, we know that alcohol and substance abuse does not cause domestic violence and sexual assault, but it definitely is a co-occurring disorder. My second concern, Mr. Chairman and committee, is we feel very strongly at the network that a representative, your representative, who you created in terms of the Office of Victims of Rights, that person who represents victims' rights, constitutional rights, rights that, you know, we have enshrined in our own Alaska Constitution, be a member of that sentencing commission. Certainly, we think the victim's constitutional rights should be regarded equally with defendant's constitutional rights, especially on any discussion of impact and fairness of sentencing laws. So I would draw your attention to that section 44.19.645 regarding the powers and duties of the commission.
Well, if you would, give us a page. Or do you have, oh, you don't have it. I was going to say, let's get the page and the number so that we are all focused on the bill. Do you have that? And again, just for the record, we're looking at version L.
You have?
I haven't found the page in the line.
I have Alaska Criminal Justice Commission. Is that the same thing?
Yes, that's what we're talking about. Where is that section?
The section that we're looking at, Mr. Chair, is on bottom of page 18.
That's the powers and the
duties. On bottom of page... From page 17 to 18.
There we go. I'm sorry, Peggy. Just wanted to make sure that we're all tracking with you. Go ahead.
So in version I have, Mr. Chairman, / L, it's page 18, line 26, powers and duties of the commission. The commission shall evaluate the effects of sentencing laws and practices on the criminal justice system to evaluate whether sentences provide for protection of the public, community, condemnation of the offender, the rights of victims of crimes, restitution from the offender, and the principle of reformation. It is in that section that we believe strongly that having a representative from the Office of Victims of Rights who can represent the constitutional rights of victims be a member of that commission. And I say that fully knowing, you know, that the sponsor and all of us like to try to keep a manageable amount of people on those commissions and panels. I'm on some myself that have been, you know, enormous. So I appreciate the limitation of that, but I do think that we feel very strongly that at least that person should be, or that office should be, on that panel.
Okay. We got your suggestion. Thank you. Thank you so much. I think what we'll do now is go to Joe Baer.
Thank you.
Joe, are you online? If so, give us your name, who you represent, and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Representative Keller and the Judicial Committee, for hearing my testimony today regarding SB 64. I am in favor of your consideration of redefining a lot of what is criminal and to what extent it's criminal. My concern today is the need to redefine sexual crimes. I know that has an awful lot of taboo associated with it, and not many people want to talk on this. But let me give you an example first, and since you can't see me, let's picture that Representative Keller and I are having a heated discussion, and he is moving into my space, and I move backwards, and now I'm up against the wall, and we're toe-to-toe. If I reach up my hands and extend them into the area of his chest to move him back, now, that could be construed as assault. That's a misdemeanor. If he tended to press charges, that's where we'd be at. Now, if he were a female in the same situation, backing me up against the wall, and I extend my hands, and any part of my hand touches any part of her breast, that is no longer a misdemeanor. That's a felony. Whether it be attempted sexual assault or sexual assault, whatever the charge is, and she does not even have to bring that forward. This is a crime against the state, and anyone that saw this can bring it forward. And anyone, whoever the female in this case was, state troopers investigate, whatnot, she says, yeah, I was touched. And I would have to say, yeah, I was trying to get her out of my space. But you know what? It doesn't matter. It's a felony. And that's the problem that we're at today. These felonies are not defined. So whether it's an attempted sexual assault or a vicious rape, the penalty can be the same. I might be able to talk my way out of some legal disagreement with Mr. Keller, who I pushed, but this crime is against the state now, not against the person, the female, that I touched her breast. So that's why I think that there needs to be some distinguishing going on here.
I really appreciate you putting that on the record, and that is what this committee is here for, and of course that's what the hopes for the commission is, that we look at those tough questions. So,
Is my comment session over?
Nope. I didn't mean to cut you off. Sir, go ahead.
I just wanted to go on with another example. My wife and I are very cognizant of sexual crimes. We, in our younger days, were both sexually assaulted. So consequently, we were very careful with our children. I never was alone with female nieces with my children. And, I bent over backwards to not be in a situation where anything could be construed as being irregular. I think this is detrimental to me as well. I just took my 2-year-old and 4-year-old grandchildren, female, and their babysitter to Bouncing Bears last weekend. As I was assisting them up and down off these inflatable toys, another young child, a little bit older than my 2-year-old, I don't know the exact age, she raises her hands to me. She wants down off this equipment. I look around. I don't see any parents. I look at the babysitter. We both shrug. I help her down. She wants back to in the entry area, which is a step away. I help her in. What happens if a parent comes up to me and says, "What the heck are you doing with my child?" I mean, these are strange things, but without clear definitions, I always feel at risk. That's my testimony.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you for taking time out of your day to call, and your testimony is noted. Andy Peavehouse, can I?
Yes, sir, I'm here.
If you would, give us your name and who you represent, and give us your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Andy Peavehouse. I represent myself. I work for the State of Alaska Public Defender Agency, but I'm here on my own behalf. I don't claim to speak for the agency at all, and I live in Kenai.
Go ahead, sir. You have the floor.
Thank you. I've been a public defender here in Kenai for 7 years, and I just wanted to speak in support of Senate Bill 64. Particularly, it has a lot of good areas, but particularly with regard to the misdemeanor felony property crime threshold. In my experience, listening to some of the earlier speakers, I definitely concur that at least here in Kenai, the police investigate on the peninsula wide. They investigate every crime and don't treat it differently, whether it's a Class B misdemeanor or a Class A felony. And likewise, in terms of prosecution, I've seen thefts prosecuted for as little as a dollar. I've seen thefts of, valued at $501 prosecuted as a Class C felony. So I don't think that there's any risk that changing the threshold is going to change how crimes are prosecuted. At least that's my take on it here in Kenai. But what I really want to focus on is, and I'm sure that you are all aware of this, but the consequences of being branded a felon are extreme, and it closes so many doors for people, and in particular, young people. If you look at crimes like theft and criminal mischief, you know, these are largely crimes of either passion or of opportunity. And changing the dollar value, I don't think, you know, if the example I like to use for criminal mischief is like a broken windshield. You know, some boyfriend, girlfriend in a fight, somebody throws a rock, the windshield is broken. You know, if that windshield is worth, if it costs more than $500 to replace, that's a felony, even though you weren't really thinking about it, and certainly whether it was a felony or a misdemeanor wasn't on your mind at the time it happened. And yet that person who was being a hothead, you know, it suddenly is can be charged and convicted with a felony. So I think that raising the threshold helps protect people who might do something obviously foolish and even illegal, but who aren't doing it necessarily because they're some kind of hardened criminal or someone who needs to be branded a felon. One point I wanted to make is that the bill, as I read it, does not change the part of the theft statute that keeps recidivist thieves from becoming felons. The law as it stands is that on your third Class A misdemeanor theft, the third one can be charged as a Class C felony. It aggravates and elevates on the third one, much like a DUI does. And so I don't think anyone needs to be concerned that if we change the threshold that, you know, we're not going to be sending the right message to people who keep at it. So if you continue to be a thief, you know, then at some point you certainly deserve that Class C felony. But I think that for, you know, based on the fact that the dollar value hasn't changed in so many years, and that, you know, what was worth $500 36 years ago, you know, today would be, I just think that there's enough of a change that it's, as the previous speaker said, it's time to update the dollar value to reflect the times.
Thank you, Andy. Don't see any questions at this time. I have to admit to being a little surprised at how much interest there is in that. We haven't heard from the burglars, you know, they aren't claiming inflation has got them quartered. Yeah, maybe that's coming. I don't know. But thank you so much for calling in. Appreciate it.
And thank you for listening.
Let's go to Jace Robertson in Kenai.
Yes, hello. This is Jace Robertson calling from the Fulbright area. And in addition to my testimony I'll provide here today, I've submitted written testimony. And in addition, I also wrote a letter to Mr. Keller, and I just would like to thank the committee here for taking the time to listen to my concerns. I agree with the gentleman earlier from the Mental Health Trust with many of the things he said. My particular support with Senate Bill 64 is the language in it regarding the conditions of release and having treatment options, basically in support of treatment versus punishment, where there being conditions for release that, you know, mandate one's sobriety or cleanliness, whether it be alcohol or drugs, because in my opinion, like I said, in my opinion, I would say at least 90% of crime can be attributed to someone's impaired judgment from one substance or another. And where I strongly support Senate Bill 64 is with the hopeful addition or amendments to be added from the language from Senate Bill 81. That bill in particular, as I outlined in my written testimony, would have a immense positive impact on my life. And I'm speaking from a point where I have, at a time in my life, had a substance abuse problem, and I've been clean and sober almost 3 years now, where I have been involved with the legal system and have been involved with rehabilitation and punishment. And it seems as though punishment is there main focus versus rehabilitation. And along, in addition to some of this other language in the bill, I agree with the changes in the felony threshold limits for theft, and I support a recidivism committee or whatever the exact wording is, but particularly the language, like I stated earlier, that supports treatment for offenders, because treatment is the true solution to substance abuse, not punishment. And I speak that, I say that from my personal experiences and from the many people I know in the recovery community and throughout our communities in general. And I know how they affect, whether it be indirectly or directly, almost every single person in our state in one way or another is impacted by substance abuse, whether it's emotional or physical pain, crimes committed, the money it costs our state and our taxpayers. It is a rampant problem statewide, and the true solution is treatment options, treatment programs, anything treatment related. And the real burden falls on the individual, and by forcing them to have some exposure when they commit a crime to treatment options, that's really all one can do, because the person committing this crime or abusing the alcohol or the drugs will not recover until they're ready. So that takes exposure to treatment and, you know, the possibilities, and that takes, you know, time and boundaries, and it forces the individual to be accountable to their own decisions. And primarily, where I mean, the language from Senate Bill 81 would be very beneficially amended to this Senate Bill 64, because where it would directly, you know, impact myself would be granting individuals like myself who have completed treatment that was outlined by the, you know, there was conditions of probation set forth that you must comply with. And by completing that court-ordered treatment, it grants the privilege to obtain a limited driver's license. My situation, I had my driver's license suspended for a minimum of 10 years, where that's an extreme hardship on one's family. And not only my family, but on the state and the taxpayer as a whole, because when one is not able to commute, to drive to and from work, and other necessities in their life, it creates a hardship on others. It creates people to eventually rely on public assistance benefits, whether it be housing or food or medical care or whatever, where being able to drive and support one's family leads to better jobs, careers, education, more access to treatment options, 12-step recovery community meetings, all those things. And it has, I mean, the hardship it has created personally on my life, I have been able to, you know, with time adapt to and somewhat overcome, but I know other people, other individuals in my life are involved in the recovery community whom I know well, you know, it's beyond explainable how difficult it is. And where it's very fair, in my opinion, is it grants limited driver's license privileges to individuals who complete treatment while still remaining strict and just and fair for those who continue to violate the law or disobey their conditions of release or probation. So it remains very fair while, you know, while also granting the state or giving the state that a step forward in the movement of recognizing treatment versus punishment. I mean, I could go on and on and on this matter on how treatment is the solution, not punishment, but I'm sure our time is limited.
I heard your testimony and appreciate it. If you would, though, wrap up, because we do have one about four or five left that we'd like to get to.
No, I understand that, and I greatly appreciate it. Appreciate your guys' time. It's just I would encourage you all to amend the language from Senate Bill 81 to 64, and it's one step closer towards a solution. Like I said, that sums it up in a nutshell, and I sincerely appreciate your folks' time today.
Well, Jace, we did hear you, and it will be considered. In fact, I'm going to switch the order here a little bit and ask Ron Taylor to come on. Ron Taylor is Deputy Commissioner for Department of Corrections. And, and just this question of treatment and the emphasis on treatment options, I just wanted to ask you how the department is doing now. I mean, how much is being spent on reducing recidivism in general terms? And how this recidivism fund that is proposed in this bill, how that will affect you. If you give us that perspective, I think it will be a good perspective as we move forward with the testimony.
Mr. Chair, can you hear me?
Loud and clear. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
This is Ron Taylor. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Corrections. And, Mr. Chair, thank you for the invitation. The department is, as you well know, Mr. Chair, has placed great emphasis on expanding rehabilitative services, especially programming, even though it represents about 6% of the total budget of the department. What you will recognize is that that has been a substantial increase of at least $1 million or $2 million over the last 3 or 4 years that we've been able to expand into educational opportunities as well as substance abuse services for those persons who are incarcerated as well as being released from our institutions. The recidivism fund in general would provide the supportive services and the reentry services that the department currently is not able to take care of when someone is in custody, such as housing, such as peer support groups and other case management services that really, once a person is released from custody, they need that added support to maintain not only sobriety, but to be able to remain crime-free and remain in the community and being productive in the community. So we know that this is something that would be a tremendous value to those persons that are actually being released from our custody as some sort of support that we're currently able as a department to provide, but certainly encourage, knowing that that is a critical part of a person being able to stay out of our system.
Thank you, Ron, for your comments, and I've enjoyed working with you on this issue. Are you so there needs to be an upgrade of like our efforts in substance abuse and education on current prisoners? This isn't all focused on when people get out, right? I mean, it's the recidivism programs right now are functioning for the inmates we have.
That is correct, Mr. Chair. We actually have expanded our institutional substance abuse programming for outpatient services and residential services, and we continue to look at ways that we can enhance our assessment capabilities inside the institution as well as in the community.
Thank you again. I don't see any questions at this time. I appreciate that you're online. I partly just wanted to call the attention to the fact that you're there. But let's go to Carmen. Carmen Gutierrez in Anchorage.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Carmen Gutierrez. I'm testifying in my capacity as a concerned citizen. As many of you may know, I had the privilege of working in the state of Alaska for about 25 years in the criminal justice system, and then the privilege of serving the state in the role of Deputy Commissioner for the Alaska Department of Corrections for 3 years. I want to strongly commend this committee and Representative Keller for the hard work that you have been doing to address meaningful reforms that will reduce recidivism and make our Alaska communities more healthy places to live. I believe that SB 64 is a great step in that direction. I'm not going to comment on every provision of the bill, but I would like to make some general comments, and I will attempt to make my comments brief and to the point.
Yes, please do, Carmen. I'm just counting here, and we have, I think, four left, and we have 10 minutes. So if you would try to stay within a couple minutes and press on.
Of course. SB 64 is really intended to promote offender accountability and to allow the Department of Corrections to use its limited hard prison beds in a more cost-effective fashion. And the bill has been supported by a number of individuals, even on the national scene. As you may well know, there's an organization that's making the conservative case for criminal justice reform. That organization is called Right on Crime. Right on Crime is very engaged in looking at cost-effective, evidence-based practices that reduce crime, reduce costs, reform offenders, prioritize victims, and protect communities. In July of 2013, Grover Norquist, one of the heads of Right on Crime, sent a letter in support of SB 64. The other members of Right on Crime are noteworthy conservatives such as Jeb Bush, Newt Gingrich, Edwin Meese, Grover, and William Bennett. So I think that there has been a recognition not only in Alaska but across the nation that the old practices of the past, if continued, are only going to give us more of the failed results in our future, and we really have a responsibility to use valuable Alaska resources in a manner that gives Alaskans the best outcomes possible. I would urge the committee to look at the opinion that was noted by Representative Grunberg. I have not read the opinion. I will do so. But as Mr. Jesse indicated, courts have been imposing via statute conditions of release and conditions of probation, and it's very hard for me to imagine how adding a condition of sobriety 24/7 would be found by our courts as being unconstitutional. The Sentencing Commission, or what we call now the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission, is something that I strongly support. The commission would be very essential in ensuring that we move forward in looking at our criminal justice system in a fashion that is looking to develop coherent, comprehensive strategies, and that we don't approach this very important problem in a piecemeal fashion. So thank you very much for the opportunity to comment today, and I sincerely appreciate the efforts that this committee is making to provide Alaskans with better outcomes for each criminal justice dollar spent. Thank you.
Thank you, Carmen, for taking time to call in. We will count on the fact that you will continue to follow our actions here, and maybe we'll get another opportunity for testimony later. Al Tomagny, if you would, Al, keep your testimony as brief as you can. We're on time here.
I represent, and I'm a member of the National Federation of Independent Business. And it's interesting hearing the comments of those predecessors that were speaking before, because none of them are really absorbing the loss. It's the business people that absorb the loss, and there really isn't enough consideration given there. We heard the topic, inflation has gone up XYZ. It depends what it's sold. You could buy a computer in 1982 for $3,000. That same computer today is $680 or so. So I think the aspect is that we have already agreed to an increase in the threshold amount from $500 to $750. I'd also like to point out that net profits have not increased 200% since 1978. for 76 on a percentage type basis. They're still very, very low. So I think the aspect is that we, as the small business entities of this state, are willing to do our share by allowing the increase to go from 500 to 750. The responsibility on that should be the other entities who make more of an effort to solve the problem. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions you may have, and sorry I took so long, but I'll be more than happy to answer any questions.
Well, I don't see any questions at this time, but we do appreciate you calling in, and we do count on the fact that you keep track of this as the you'll probably want to have input later as we actually get specifically to that issue. So thanks for taking the time to call in. Betty Bear, if you would, keep your testimony really short and concise, and if you're there, identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chairman Keller. She doesn't wish to testify at this time, but has sent down written testimony.
That would be super. Tell her we appreciate that, and we will make sure that the committee gets a copy of the written testimony. We have Rick Allen from the Director of Public Advocacy, and we've got Quinlan Steiner from Alaska Public Defenders. And what I want to do is give you the option to either testify or get first bite of the apple on Friday at 2:00 when we come back. I'll leave that up to you, whichever you would prefer. So Rick Allen, we'll start with you. If you would like to add a few things, please keep it brief. And if not, we'll give you the first bite of the apple on Friday.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will try to keep it under a minute. For the record, my name is Rick Allen, and I am the director of the Office of Public Advocacy. The Office of Public Advocacy does not generally take positions on proposed legislation, and we take no official position on this bill. I'm testifying today regarding the felony threshold portion of SB 64, and I'd like to discuss briefly the applicability of the current law. I was a state prosecutor for over 7 years before becoming the public advocate, and I can tell you that the current law is strictly prosecuted in many parts of our state. I personally indicted at least two people for felony theft for stealing bicycles worth over $500. And in my last trial as an assistant district attorney in 2011, I successfully prosecuted a man for walking into a Target and walking out with a $600 stereo. We brought the case to grand jury, we litigated various motions, and finally held a multi-day felony trial in Superior Court. That particular defendant was sentenced to 2 years in prison. So to punish a man for stealing a $600 item, the state of Alaska paid over $100,000 in prosecution, defense, and incarceration costs. And so I just think at this point the Alaska legislature needs to decide if that math pencils out to anybody but Target. And thank you very much for your time, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Powerful testimony. Thank you, Rick. Quinlan? Same option, if you want, start.
Mr. Chairman, if you have
a couple minutes testimony, give it to us. Quinlan?
I'm happy to, I know you're running up against 3:00. I'm happy to just bring my testimony on Friday. I was planning on appearing and being available on Friday anyway. I'm happy to do that.
I appreciate it. We got you to sit there and listen to all the way through this, so I appreciate that a lot. I don't see any questions at this time, so we'll close public testimony for now, and we'll probably open it back up. We'll for sure open it back up as we go forward. Two things, housekeeping or three. One is Representative Pruitt joined us quite a while ago. I forgot to say that he's here. The other thing is in the paperwork in front of you, you've got two potential House Judiciary bills. If you have real problems, make sure you talk to Ernest right away. Otherwise, we'll drop those in. One's by request, and the other one, Representative Gruenberg and myself have been looking at. And so with that, if there's nothing else, we'll get to order. We're out at 3:00 on time. Can you believe it?